Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to the... Hang on, let me work this out on my fingers. Okay, there was the first one, and there was the second one. The third film
Amazing.
In the John Wick series. It is John Wick Chapter 3. Chapter 3.
There's a clue in the title.
Clue is in the title. Parabellum, which means prepare for war, I think. They say it in the movie.
More or less.
I'm guessing that's what it actually kind of means. It is a glorious 2 hours of utter mayhem, featuring more inventive kills than you could shake a knife at. And here to talk about it with me over the next, well, not too long, because we don't have a lot of time, is Helen O'Hara. And it's just two of us, just me and you, Helen, on this one.
Just the two of us. Hello.
Indeed. Because one of the reasons people might be asking why this podcast has been slightly delayed is because logistical reasons. Basically, we've been trying to figure out a time when three or four of us would be able to get in the studio and talk about John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum.
And we have failed. We've failed miserably.
We got up to the start line a couple of times, and then things happened and fell apart. And we'll spare you the internal strife that led to this.
But there was bloodshed.
So basically, now Helen and I, we found 20-30 minutes in our schedules, and we've decided to come in and have and chew the fat over this movie.
Not that there's much fat on anyone in this movie, because they're all super trained.
Even the dogs. Lean and mean, cock-biting machines.
And they're all very good boys, aren't they?
They really are. 14 out of 10, I would say, for this. But anyway, it won't just be me and Helen that you will hear in this spoiler special. You will be delighted to know. We're going to hear, first of all, from the man who is the architect of the John Wick world. He is the man who co-directed the first movie with David Leitch. And since then, he has taken over sole stewardship of the two movies, John Wick Chapter 2 and now Parabellum as well. And he is Jads Tehelski. And he is a delight to talk to. I'm struggling to remember a more confident director. Someone who is more confident in what he has put on the screen and in his abilities to marshal mayhem. And rightly so, I think you would say. He's a stuntman by trade who has then moved into directing as well. But he's got this incredible eye. These movies look beautiful as well. And he's pretty good on the old story side as well. So James Dyer and I went along to talk to him when he was in London recently. And we filled our spoiler boots. Do please enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director of John Wick Chapter 3, Parabellum, Jads Tehelski. How are you, sir?
Good, thanks. How are you guys?
Yeah, not too bad. A lot to talk about in this movie. So I thought we should get right into it and start with the end.
Sure.
Because the end isn't the end.
Well, it's funny, like, you know, everybody, I get asked a lot, like, look, we did the first John Wick, and by the time the thing came out, me, my co-director Dave Leitch and Kent, we were all looking for other jobs. We thought we'd never work again. Like, I was right back thinking about, fuck, I gotta go back to being a stunt guy. And then we did number two, and we're like, holy shit, this one worked too. I mean, we don't write any of these to be a continuation. I certainly didn't mean for number two to be a cliffhanger. It was never written that way, and certainly we had a different ending for number three that just it kind of sucked. It just didn't work. It kind of ended like, ah, bummer. So we kind of tweaked the ending a little bit to go back to the Bowery King and stuff. But it's not meant to be a cliffhanger. I know it definitely is. Don't get me wrong. I'm very aware of that. But like, we didn't write it that way. It just, with our thematics of consequence and fate and karma, and you know, you do bad things happen to you. I mean, I'll ask you guys, what the fuck do you think was going to happen? Like, what, he's going to ride off into the sunset? Like, okay, he killed 100 and, you know, whatever people, and it's all good. It's all good, all forgiven. Yeah. Like, he's fucked. Like, he was fucked from the first movie. He's fucked in the second movie. He's fucked in the third movie. So we just figured, like, look. It's like life. You can have a great day and the next day is shit. Or you can have a shitty day and a shitty day and a shitty day to get to the good day. But you got to wake up the next day. And I never really got off where you can get away with these massive action sequences. And like the next day, it's like back to, you know, the wife and the kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we're just like, okay, John's fucked. He's going to have broken bones for the next year of his life. He'll be in physical rehab for the next year. So like we just went, we'll take this as far as we can go, okay? Falls off the roof. He breaks every bone in his body. He managed to lift one hand, flip off the Bowery King. That's a fuck you back to the entire world. And boom, he's in rehab. Like, he's getting pins playing. Because, like, no one will survive that shit. So I doubt the next film, if there was a next film, was going to pick up exactly where the third one ends off. I mean, John needs a little R&R.
It could be interesting, though.
We just figured, like, how else are you going to end something like this? Like, he's
fucked.
He owns
a dog home. Something like that.
Exactly, right? So there you go.
I don't know. John Wick and traction would be an interesting way to go.
Yeah, you know, the body cast, it's very sexy.
He'd still kick some ass. I mean, how early in the process did the Winston betrayal come into this? Like, was that always where you wanted to go with this?
You know, we have the same problem every time we try to do another John Wick, when we try to bring in an outside writer or something like this to try and help with ideas, which is kind of a mandate. Like, you know, at the end of the day, it's Karen and I with our main writer just putting stuff together. And you got to get your head around the plot point that it's not a good guy movie. Mm. Like, you can't keep putting a chivalrous thing. Our version of chivalry and etiquette is flopped. Like, there's respect there, but it's not out of the humanity of respect. It's about if you don't respect somebody, you get your head shot off. It's just everybody in our movie is a bad guy. Like, John Wick, at the essence, he's an assassin. He's a bad guy. Mm. Like, he kills people for, like, I mean, where are you going to take that? Does he have love? Does he have respect? Does he have empathy? Does he want absolute? Of course. He's trying to make a change, but he's done things that probably aren't that redeemable. So he can do it within his world, but, like, we don't have that. Like, what did you expect of Winston? Like, if you had, I mean, I like putting characters in this, painting them into a karmic corner where, like, if you were in those things, okay, it's like, you know, two people are drowning, your daughter and your wife, who do you save? Mm-hmm. Like, I love that kind of conundrum. Is it an unanswerable question? Yes. But again, I grew up with construction and a lot of friends in the military, and stunts were like logistics and reality. Like, you can't just bullshit your way through. Like, you're going to step off that ledge. You can talk and boast all you want, but you gotta have your shit together, or there's a consequence. Most people don't have to go those kind of consequences. Mm. I've actually been painted into corners, and I try to draw on that to put, like, John Wick has been painted into a corner. Winston's been painted, like, the high table. Like, it's not like the regular good guy movies where, like, you can beat, like, you can beat Thanos, you can beat the insurmountable odds. Like, in John Wick, you will never beat the high table, ever. It's like the U.S. government. You will never beat them. You can survive. You can negotiate. You can have temporary moments of peace and tranquility, or you can be at war. But you're never going to solve the problem. It's insolvable. It's a Gordian knot. Mm-hmm. So what was it going to be? Again, was it going to be, I throw it back to you guys, we're going to be a fucking happy ending? Winston's going to throw down the magic fucking coin and, like, okay, so I'm going to end, kill everybody I know, lose my hotel, get put out on the fucking street, or I turn over one dude. Like, come on, there isn't a human on the planet that wouldn't do that.
It's an interesting thing to dig into, though, about Winston's motivations for this, because you could argue that he does it because he loves his place in that world. Mm-hmm. He loves being the manager of the Continental. He keeps saying in the film, I've been doing this for 40 years, yeah. Which...
Fealty.
You know, I've served, I will be of service, all that stuff. But you could also maybe argue, I don't know whether you guys were layering this in Chapter 2 as well, when he gives John that extra hour, is that a power play on his part? Is he playing the long game, essentially?
He is. Winston plays three-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
You know, three-dimensional being like, you know, you can always play the board or you play the man. I think any great chess player plays both. You assess the man, but you play the board. And I think that's what Winston's doing.
Yeah, he has eyes on loftier roles. Yeah,
it's funny. We come from a heavy, heavy jiu-jitsu background, so you're always thinking three moves ahead. You're fighting, like, so we layer that into, like, that's the subtext. I mean, without getting too wacky and directorially freaky. we try to put that in. And again, you know, you got to look at John. Mm. John, if you really, really tore apart the John Wick ethos or the mythos of everything, is, like, John Wick broke the rules. Our whole big thing is consequence, just like life. Like, there are things you'll do when you're 15 that'll still tweak you, you know, in your 40s and 50s. I mean, I know that, but anyway. If John didn't break the rules in the first movie, he wouldn't be here in the third one. Like, Winston didn't break the rules. Santino D'Antonio in the second one didn't break the rules. Halle Berry didn't break the rules. No, really, John did. And you wonder why he's fucked. It just shows you step out of line, there will be consequences.
Consequence is a big theme in the movie. You know, yeah.
Gave you a happy ending, we would be worse than the characters in the movie. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's the way it is. You got to deal with it.
Yeah, you can be honest about the world that you're living
in. I think big part, just like in life, you got to take responsibility.
Yeah.
John's taking responsibility, but I don't like it. You know, he wants to keep fighting, which is, again, another human testament to, like, I choose to live.
Do you see these three films in a way as John's descent into hell in a weird way?
I'm a big fan of Dante.
Yeah.
You know, and you can, I mean, obviously, Dante's in the movie. It's funny, like, it's really weird. Any theme, music, prop, I don't know, ode to framing, honestly, John Wick is... become a chance for Keanu and I to really say thank you to everybody we work with. I mean, we came up with some of the best filmmakers in the business. Mm-hmm. Him as a cast member, me as a second unit and action director. And to put it on screen is great. But the algorithms behind the themes, absolutely. I mean, it's not only the descent, whereas Dante dealt with simply the descent and the escape of for a noble cause. We're more about the navigation and not escaping hell, but living and navigating in it.
From my eyes, anyway, there's an increase in religious imagery in the film as well. I mean, huge. You literally have a crucifix as John's ticket into the underworld.
Very intentional.
And he obviously goes to the desert as well to find himself, and there are temptation
there's a lot of
in the
cross,
desert.
Methodologies.
And when the ticket is stamped on him, it's an upside down cross. So I noticed as well. Can you talk about that and layering that stuff into the film?
I mean, without going into personal opinion of religion and ideologies and stuff, it's. For me, it's always the testament. Why is there religion? You know, what do people need from it? What do they benefit from it? And how do you play with the... The most interesting to me is the iconology of it. Why a crucifix? Why this? Why this? Why? What do people associate with it? And again, just like we try to be very, very... And, you know, the word diversity now has got such a different meaning. I don't really think about checking boxes when I cast. Or locations or ethnicities or gender. We just write cool characters and they kind of pop up. We certainly don't have a demographic percentage of what we're trying to fill. And I think that's the same way I look at, like, ideology or religion. It's just, it's part of human nature. And at the base thing, we're all about mythology. So you have the Greek god mythology, which is, I hope, permeates very prominently. And then you have Russian Orthodox vibe, which is pretty prevalent, which is where you see the crucifixes and all that. But it mostly comes down to the rules and the parameters of that and how we're bending it. And I kind of like that idea behind it, that it can be used more about the, I guess, the character background and subtext than it is about the actual religion. You know, what it kind of means and how we blend it in. It's just part of human history. And if you needed a ticket home, what's better than... You know, the iconology of what, if you notice, every ballerina in there has a crucifix or hanging on the chairs or all like that. They all have a version of John Wick's tattoo. And they're all, like, as you can tell, I got a, thing for Latin, I guess. it's funny, people go, well, I didn't know what fealty meant before the trailer. I'm like, well, okay, we tried to educate. And Parabellum and, like, amuse bouche, Americans aren't big onto what amuse bouche. I get asked so many times in the States, and what is this amuse bouche thing? I'm like, oh, just look it up.
Yeah.
So you can tell them. It's like, I'm glad it kind of means something.
You mentioned mythology. I mean, there's a whole layer of extra mythology added in terms of Angelica Houston's character and the ticket as we speak. Then we find out also, pertinently, John Wick is not John Wick. He's a Belarusian national himself. I mean, where did that idea come from to add in a layer? And they're separate from the high table in, under it, but
the
not
Ruska Roma.
Yeah.
I love the gypsy mentality. We did a lot of research into that. And, we've seen so many movies about... where assassins come from, and there's always that scene, you guys know it, where some dude from the NSA or the CIA or some cop opens a folder and they show you a picture of going, look, Bob here is 3 years as Navy SEAL, is this, the Rambo thing. And look, that just, you're always told how badass the guy is. Our big rule in John Wick is like, you're going to see it.
Yeah.
No one's going to tell you the backstory on Sophia. You're just going to watch her do her thing and go, because no words can really hold up to what you're about to see.
Yeah.
You can say he's good with knives, but, that knife fight speaks for itself. You know what I mean? He's good on horses. Like, he rode a road. You don't say it, just show it.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to define it. And the same thing goes with identity. Hopefully you'll watch John, you'll watch the empathy that Keanu has. Like, Keanu plays it very, we call it big screen acting. He'll play with looks.
Yeah.
John Wick, purposely so, says very little, but tells a lot, and you just want to know what's important to him. Why do you want to live? Like, when he says something, it should land, and let everybody else do the yapping. When we started talking about, look, we're going to give, people want to know where he's from. We've already established the martial arts he do is very, Sambo is a Russian martial arts, like Judo, Jiu-Jitsu. Smirsh is a gun tactic that a lot of the Russians use that we kind of stole from originally. So we're going to have a background in this. Now, is John Wick Russian or Belarusian? Don't know, but we know where he kind of was raised. That was a little cue with the ballerinas and the kids doing Sambo and the director's thing. Does he speak Russian? Yeah, but he speaks Japanese. He does sign language. He speaks Chinese. Yeah, he's got a lot of language. So I love, a huge fan of, like, the old Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns and, Pale Rider and stuff. It's the man with no name thing.
Yeah.
You learn more about the guy through the current story, and I like the audience filling his backstory. So many times it's a very American Hollywood way of giving backstory before you meet the character.
Yeah.
Like, is that like that in life? Do everybody you meet, do you fucking IMDb him before you, you know what I mean? You meet and you start putting it together. And then as you get to know the person, you know, over the course of a year, you find out a lot about their backstory. So John Wick, I want the audience to meet John Wick now and deal with his empathy and deal with his pain. And like, I mean, honestly, do you give a fuck about where he ate breakfast when he was 21?
Well,
like,
more importantly,
you want to learn it now.
The more you know, sometimes the less interesting these characters are.
Exactly.
So, I mean, so, Mystique is his thing.
Yeah, Mystique. And you're getting to know him as... and honestly, you're getting to know him as Keanu. I know him. Like, if you think I go back to my house and I have this John Wick room that has 20 years of subtext and backstory to him, you're wrong. Like, what's fun about these things and why we keep coming back is, like, it's fun for us.
Yeah.
Like, there is no mythical room at Lionsgate where there's three writers writing John Wick backstory. Like, you know, like, the good thing is, like, you know, a lot, I would say a lot of John Wick is actually from observations of Keanu. Like, he's not, you know, there's a lot that's actually Keanu. There's a lot that's actually me, the love of action, all the stuff we do. There's a lot of Keanu and I of, we both love, Keanu's actually worked with Bertolucci. Mm-hmm. You know, we're both Tarkovsky fans. We're both Steven Spielberg fans. I mean, you can see that we're both Ridley Scott fans. We're both obviously spent 10 years with the Wachowskis. If you can't smell the Wachowski on these films, then I don't know what to tell you. I mean, if I'm going to rip somebody off, it's going to be them.
Yeah.
And everything I know about world building is through them. You know, it's just, John Wick offers me and my crew the opportunities to be weird, wacky, and do whatever we want. I mean, you know how I get, people go, how the fuck did you get Dan Lauston to work with you? I'm like, that's a good fucking question. Because he is an A-list cinematographer who has, I mean, old school in the sense that he lights in camera. When you see a lot of this, I'm doing very little in digital intermediate. I'm just enhancing what he's already set up. So the chance is like, here you go, I'm going to build a world, and I want you to give me everything you got and don't hold anything back. I mean, how many people get that crew? When I tell the stunt team, no, you're gonna work this weekend because I want more. Like, that's not average, you know? And when you tell your cameraman, no, you're going to every rehearsal. You're coming on 2 months early just to rehearse. Because, like, you guys got to be around dogs, you got to be around horses, you got to... The cameraman, are you fucking kidding me? Usually they bring us on the day. Like, I don't know if you guys know, but cameraman usually don't see the sequence till the day. And that's why it takes so long to shoot stuff. That dog sequence, I shot in less than 4 days. Most crews would have taken 4 weeks.
Wow.
You know, I do 50 setups a day. Most people get 10 setups a day. It's just, you know, I spend a shitload of money in prep and rehearsals.
Yeah, and it shows on screen. I mean, this, I don't think it's outrageous to say this has some of the most incredible action sequences of the three films so far.
Thanks.
I mean, because with each one, you've kind of topped it. I mean, how much does that play into it? Like, do you start with, you know what would be really fucking cool? Let's get some dogs, let's get them in a suit, and let's kill a bunch of guys with them. You know, is that, what's that, the process?
You just described the actual process. I shit you not. That was, I'm a huge dog fan. It's like, I'm tired of fucking, okay, look, I love the pit bull. I love all our dogs. I love them. They're great. But they just sit there and drool a lot. You know, so like, cool, but we're going to use. And I spend my days, literally I go to the office every day and just, you know, go to the gym. Then we'll go research. Then I'll spend some time with the stunt team. Then I'll go to like every museum and then whatever city I'm in. And it's just research, research, research. I love dogs and you see what's capable. We barely touched on what Belgian Malinois can do. If I did a second film and brought Sophia back with her dogs, you would see stuff that would blow this shit away. Like, there's always more. I mean, think about it. Like, when you guys say, like, look, I'm not going to knock. And people think I'm anti-CG and all that. I'm not. If you want to edit fast, I think Greengrass did a great job. I think for that Bourne that he brought in, shaky cam, he did it for a reason. My only beef is when people do it to hide shit.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't spend time in prep and you think it's like going on a honeymoon, right? If you get to Fiji and you expect some magic to happen on that island that you didn't bring with it, you're deluding yourself. You know, if you're not bringing the magic with you, it ain't going to be there on the island.
Damn it.
You know, so if you don't bring some magic into your choreography and your action sequences and you expect fast editing and somebody shaking a camera really fast to give you something to a bad performance because you didn't want to spend money on rehearsals, you didn't have a cast member, you didn't hire the right stunt team, well, you know, fuck you. That's cheating the audience. You know, if you want to do good action, fucking do good action. It ain't that fucking hard. Practice, set it up, and have a plan. Some people can't make decisions. Big problem in directing. Some people don't understand. They expect other people to do it. Some people want to go, I just want to direct the actors and let the stunt guy do the action. All right, that's great, but why the fuck did you take the movie? When 40% of your movie is action, and you don't go do the research of action, like what takes a good action, what makes it, then you're not directing. You're phoning it in. You're a shitty director. I don't care. Like, I'll stand toe-to-toe with anybody. I'll direct five guys in a room talking, or I'll direct five guys doing a car chase. But I went both ways and researched it. The friends I know, the directors I respect, Wachowskis do it. Spielberg does it. Nolan does it. The best director, Fincher, does it. You know, they all go out and research how to do their, because they know that the storytelling doesn't stop when the action starts. If anything, it tells you even more about the characters. So fucking do your research. Mm. So when you get into stuff like, you know, how do we do better action? It's not really that. It's like, okay, exactly what you said. That's how it starts. Fucking dogs. I'm going to do this. That's great. Let's fucking do it. Then you got to research doing it. Then Keanu sit down and say, okay, great. This is going to be great. We'll do the test. We did it. Like, it is possible to do this. Okay. Now, okay, that takes up 3 minutes of the movie, so what are we going to do? Okay, the bond between him and Sophia. It's an avatar for a daughter. How do we lace the story into that? And that's what becomes the challenging part. Mm-hmm. Like, look, there's a shitload of action in this. Hopefully you're still learning something. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. Some of it's just, you know, fuck you. Look at this. It's cool. Right? But some of it is you're getting to know John Wick in it. I mean, should be, for me, I look at a lot of the action as world building. I was walking around New York over a year ago, and it was freezing because it was right around Christmas. And I was walking through Central Park, and they had little carriages with the horses. And I was just asking the guys, I was like, so where the fuck do horses go? Oh, it's a stable, right? Like, what? Right off Fifth Ave, there's this little stable, and you'd never know it. Walk in, there's fucking 30 horses in there. And I'm like, oh, John Wick's running one of these. Because as a stunt guy, I was remember training for one thing, and I was in a stable, and I got kicked by a horse. And I thought I was a pretty tough dude. And I got kicked in the shoulder and the arm, and that thing sat me down. I didn't lift my arm for a week. So I'm like, John was going to fight with a horse.
Yeah.
And then Ken was like, oh, fucking ride a horse. I'm like, suit, right? And I was like, fuck, you're going to ride a horse. And then you start writing the story behind it. Yeah. The big problem is when you write that much action, it's like, okay, is it going to fit? Is it too much? Like, look, I'm going for action fatigue in this. I want you to feel a little burned out. Uh-huh. And it wasn't any one sequence. Like, to answer you guys' long-winded answer here. When you do something, I'm not trying to outdo myself.
Yeah.
We don't sit down and go, how do we? We've never asked that. And I think if I did, I'd probably fuck it up because you'd try. I don't want a bigger, better sequence. This one was a lot of a little. Like, John Wick throws knives, he rides horses, he climbs the beach, we have dog. Like, hopefully there's something for everybody. I love asking people what your favorite action sequence is. I haven't got more than, you know, everybody's answered something different. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You know, no one's really hated one or loved the other. They've all liked their favorite thing. Like, I like the underwater gun thing. I mean, that's real cavitation. I like the knife
fight. That's a question lots of people have. Like, because in a lot of films, you see people being shot underwater. It's like, well, with the resistance, that's not going to happen.
No, that's a real deal. That's real physics. And the distance is proper, too.
You got like 2 feet of
9mm. That's an MPX underwater, and it'll shoot about 5.5 feet. Yeah. We've done the tests. We actually...
But it's genius, because he gets distance from him because he knows it's not going to go there. And I'm like, what are you doing?
It's like, and that's it. And like, you guys are boys. I mean, I'm sure at some point you took mom's kitchen knives and tried to throw knives into your tree, right? How many times did they stick? How many times did they bounce back and hit you?
Literally never.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's the same thing with the professional knife guys and us. So the whole knife fight started like, how many fucking movies do you see? And no matter what the guy picks up, not a throwing knife, a kitchen knife, it sticks in. Yeah. I have been hit by a knife full speed and it's bounced off me. All right? So we're like, well, fuck it. John Wick's going to throw knives. He's going to throw that. And we call, I mean, if you guys have little brothers, sister, friends, like snowball fight.
Yeah.
Like everybody just fucking throws as many snowballs as they can as fast as you can. Some hit, some bounce off. So we just decided we're going to have a realistic knife fight with snow. And people are just going to throw knives. Some stick, some don't. Some win, some don't.
Yeah.
And then John Wick finds a distance, goes, fuck you, fuck you, fuck. You know, so that's where that came about. And like, reality is funner than that. Like, underwater, that's really what happens. Mm. And when you see tactical gun work, like, they shoot everybody in the fucking head. Like, when you see John Wick doing, like, that's real. Like, people run out of bullets. People, there are at least a half a dozen times in the movie where Keanu's actual gun jams, and we just don't. 90% of films would cut. Keanu, like, it happens in the beginning of the Riyadh fight. It happens in the hotel lobby fight. He just clears his own gun and keeps going. Like, he's doing real clearing, real reloads.
That's amazing.
That's a fun thing. So reality sometimes gives you the diversity you need.
Yeah.
Going back to the beginning of the film, because the beginning of the film delivers what you set up in chapter 2, which is everyone in the world is trying to kill John Wick and it is relentless and he's trying to survive. And that's all he's trying to do, trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And can you talk about that? Did you think at any point trying to make that the entire movie? Because it does slow down after that and then John does try and get out.
Yeah, no, pacing is a big thing. And like all the time I spent like 10 years as a second unit guy, and you do a lot of cleanup or fixing things in other films. And you realize that the two biggest problems nearly all the time in any action film is tone. Mm-hmm. You know, tone is all over the place. Is it serious? Is not? They're trying to be funny. And then pacing, as it goes slow and fast. You know, pacing has become this main note when people review or do test screenings of your movie, whether it's from the studio or the audience. My answer to that is like, you know, if everything was fast, there'd be nothing slow, right? Mm-hmm. Slow enough. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to find a rhythm. Like, if you just listen to techno, you fucking shoot yourself. But if you listen sometimes to classical, like you listen to some versions of Haydn, and you again, you want to fucking hang yourself. So, you know, you get a Beethoven where it's da-da-da-da, then you're going and you got ups and downs. So, like, yeah, it was meant to, like, I wanted to start it, like, the first movie was incredibly slow in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Incredibly. And that was our whole thing. The second movie is a little bit different. It starts good, but then it's really, really slow. And then the last third, it really picks up. So this time I did, instead of the back half or the middle, you know, third act in the first one, second act, we're going to go heavy on the first act, and then I'm just going to slow it down. And, you know, you get, okay, the desert's really, really slow. Oh, yeah, fucking, he's walking across the desert. You want to be fucking fast? What do you want to do, John? Like, you know, he answers these things like, you got to have slow to have fast. And otherwise, I think it'd just be this fucking blur of fucking fight scenes. So, yeah, I wanted the first, like, I love Run Lola Run, the Tom Tickford film. Mm-hmm. You know, and I like movies that start off, I'm not too big of a fan of, like, the opening action sequence. Like, sometimes Bond will do it, and Bond does it very well, but we just didn't want to be Bond. Obviously, not a Mission Impossible. So, you know, it'll be non-related to, you know, big action sequence, opening credits, and then the start of the story. This time, we're just like, yeah, fuck it. 20 minutes, we're going to get him out of town, and hopefully in that, you meet the doctor again, Randall Kim, and then you get to see the mom, you know, the director, Angelica Houston. You've got Winston narrating, so you're seeing a couple different threads, and we decided if you could do it. Cool opening action sequence, but thread the story a little bit. That gave us the, okay, we've got your attention now. This isn't John Wick 2. This is a little bit different. And then you're willing to buy a little favor with the audience to sit back and just relax a little bit and tell a story and show some pretty pictures and show the desert and show some fucking camels. And then, you know, we get back in and then we can kick it back up again. And that was a very conscious choice. Yeah. So whether you love it or hate it, at least, I want to try something different.
Well, you mentioned the desert, and that adds a whole new dimension to what the high table is, that there's a man who sits above the high table and lives in a tent. Where did he come from?
Again, you go to Bond or the Mission Impossibles, there's Spectre or a version of Spectre. Right? The shadow government, the shadow realm. And we were like, well, you know, we kind of set up the high table haphazardly. We kind of set up the high table. We're like, okay, we're going to show that. And like, well, wait a minute. Everybody shows the fucking high table. It's some bald guy in a wheelchair with the cat or something like this, right? And we didn't want the evil thing. We didn't want to show. So like, well, in our world, everything's a little fucked. So let's have a moral high ground. Let's have a guy that sets the etiquette. You know, the guy that tells you about the markers, the guy that sets the tone of our world. Mm. And everybody looks to him because it was just a high table. I mean, at the end of the day, criminals care about, like, you know, money. It's not really world domination, not like Thanos. It's not like that. But it's about financials and stuff. And that's something we didn't really want to touch on. Mm. It seemed too grounded for us. So what's cooler than just a group of bad guys? Well, how about the bad guy that sets the morality and the ethics for the bad guy? And that's where we came up with the Elder. And we thought that was interesting. Like, ooh, and that's where you set the rules. Like, we're always about rules. And again, I love Greek mythology. That's more about twisted morality.
Yeah.
You know, slightly bent. And I like our version of morality because it's not altruistic. It's actually achievable. Mm. You give a marker, fine. Can't kill anybody in this fucking hotel. This is it. The rest is pretty open for interpretation. More like guidelines. Like, this is, and that seems like for a human being achievable, especially like, you can't put, you know, the chivalry of the Knights of the Round Table, because, like, not even the knights held up that shit. Like, you know, like, look at Game of Thrones. They all fucking shit on each other. So we're like, what's a cool thing? And Kanai went out and was like, no. And it was actually Kanai. He was like, we're going to call him the Elder, but he's not going to be old. We're like, all right, we get that. And we just wanted something, again, odd, slightly off kilter. Mm. And that's probably the hardest thing about Wick, is like, how do you not fit into all the boxes of everybody else and do the slightly off kilter thing?
And he gives up his wedding ring. Now, the thing that kind of shocked me was not even that he gave up his finger. I was like, yeah, totally. But giving up his ring, that's a big deal.
We, again, you can do the Yakuza thing with chopping off the pinky. The finger was not about the finger. I'm glad you guys got that. Everyone thought, you know, when you read the script, he's giving up a finger. It's not about that. The only, if you listen to him, the only reason he keeps going is he wants to remember his wife. Mm. In all three movies, he plays with that fucking ring all the time. Sort of like when the Elder says it, the Elder's not asking for a finger. He's not asking for anything. He's asking for John to make a choice. Are you going to be John or are you going to be John Wick? That's really the subtext. And you have to choose which one you're going to be. And you can't choose both if you're remembering the other. So he's asking John for his humanity and his memories. He's asking for that one thing that's grounding him into the one thing that's holding John from being the boogeyman.
Yeah.
And John knows instantly what he's talking about. And, you know, there's a choice, a hammer or a chisel, and a lot can happen. Like, we don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. And John just instantly is aware of what the one thing, what that one umbilical cord to real life is. And he takes it, and the wedding ring is that. And the best way to show fealty just wasn't about chopping off a finger. It was about giving up who he was fighting for. And I think that's probably the best piece of symbolism I've ever done in my life. I'm glad somebody got it. So like one out of the 18 million is good. So thanks, guys. I appreciate that.
But it's interesting as well, because then he goes to kill Winston and can't go through with it.
He absolutely can. He is absolutely prepared to kill Winston. Absolutely prepared. Mm. Absolutely 100% prepared to kill Winston.
Which slightly, in some way, softens Winston's betrayal slightly. That Cannon was prepared to kill him. He's prepared to turn him. So, you know, as you say, they operate under a different set of rules.
Yeah. I think it's there. I think that, like, again, I love slightly... that's why I always love graphic novels and Japanese anime. There's an obtuseness to the characters and who they really are. Again, without telling them being... A lot of times when you write a story, the hero has to be this altruistic. So let me get this right. You're an assassin with a heart that protects little girls, but you kill family. Okay, what? you know, and every movie has... They're very easy. Whenever it suits the movie or the plot point... And I guess, you know, everyone's got this thing like the audience won't, you know, have empathy for him unless he does this and he says this and he's got to say, well, I wouldn't, like, how many movies have you seen like that? And like, that's not the way it works. So we may be completely fucking surreal in set pieces and action, but we try to keep, and I know it sounds funny, but we try to keep fairly grounded with human emotion.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like, yeah, Winston's fighting for that, but he is a bit of a puppet master. He is playing on that, but, you know, and John is probably too altruistic for his own good. You know, he believes his own bullshit, really, and that's what he wants to do. You know, that's what he's fighting for. And I guess at that point you have to fight for something. We all have that in our lives. So,
but now he's mega pissed, and Parabellum, as Winston says, means prepare for war. So you said there was another ending to this movie, but at what point did you realize that this was going to set up a chapter 4 in which presumably that war might happen?
Well, I came into this going, I was already prepping another film, and they came back asking to do number 3, and I was a bit of a dick. And I was like, oh, if we do this, this, and this, and no one's going to tell me what to do, and I can do this, and this, and this, and they said yes. And I was like, ah, fuck.
I should be a dick more.
But like, one of the things that I really wanted is like, I wanted John Wick to die. I'm like, he's dead. There's nowhere else. I mean, he's fucked. He's dead. There's no way out of this. He's dead. And I'm going to end it, and I don't want to be that guy that keeps carrying this out. He's dead. And then, you know, Keanu didn't want to die. Keanu loves hardcore. He loves hard-boiled. Loves it.
Yeah.
But, like, he's like, fuck, I love this guy. And the studio came back, what are you fucking thinking, dude? Like, everybody loves it. I'm like, okay. Well, then it's got to be, I'm not doing the ride-off into the sunset anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it's just fucked. And ultimately, that worked out best for both parties, because I didn't want to end it with a happy ending, which ultimately leads to the idea of a cliffhanger, which ultimately leads to, yes, there's an option for if you know how fucking lucky I am? Like, I'm sitting here before you guys because, like, some really small, wacky action movie did well. So that's always a thing to be thankful for. And if people wanted another one, like, yes, I would love to help, at least in the development and creativity of where it goes from there. Mm-hmm. I think it's a cool character. And as an action director, are you kidding? Like, fucking horses, dogs, guns, knives. It's awesome. You know?
And the idea as well, I mean, you said early on that the high table cannot be defeated, but it sounds to me like the Bowery King is really fucking pissed off.
Dude, I love Lawrence Fishburne and that whole world, the homeless world, and it's super fascinating to me, and what the capabilities are with that. And I love the Asian vibe we have going on with ninjas and martial arts. Mm. I mean, you guys know, like, you came up with genre films and graphic novels. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me.
Yeah.
Like, all that stuff. And that's not really embraced, or it's been watered down to be little parts of it. And you just can't give a guy a sword and call him a ninja. You can't just give a guy a gun and call him an action hero. Like, you know, we're trying to put some work back into all the things we loved, and hopefully that comes out. If we can do another one and bring all that back in and keep pushing genre, you know, whether it's the martial art, kung fu, graphic novel thing, that's great. I think that's the funnest part. It's like, I don't have any rules.
Yeah.
So
what might happen? Because there's that fascinating thread. I mean, you talk about consequences throughout the movie, and there's moments when Winston and the Bowery King, for example, who have been operating in their own little fiefdoms, I almost feel that they're impervious in a way to the rules, and those rules are imposed upon them, and they reacted very, very different ways.
I think that was the genius behind Keanu coming up with the adjudicator. You know, you can see the world through her eyes, where, like, no one's above the rule. otherwise, if you took out that character, it's just you can kind of see it. It's like Gangs of New York. Everyone's got their fiefdom, but there's no controlling for it. It's nice to see somebody come in and visit the worlds to get exactly what you just brought up. Winston handles it one way, Bowery King handles another, John handles it a third way, Zero handles it. Like everyone, the director, there's also a scene with the doctor. Like everyone's handling it in a way. And just by their, just even by Lawrence Fishburne even stepping down and Winston showing fealty, it can show, you learn a lot about the High Table just through the reactions. And that's kind of the mentality we had about John Wick in the first film. We never told you anything about John. It's just how, you know, John Leguizamo and how Lance, how everybody reacted to him. Like, oh, fuck, he's a badass. And he never had to show it because everybody just respected him as a badass. That's the fun part, you know. But have you ever been in New York? I mean, talk about worlds and subworlds. Yeah. Like, that city's kooky, man. Mm.
You totally know, so. Believe that this sort of subculture of assassins could Absolutely. Exist there.
I was just there, and I it's probably there. it's an interesting city for sure.
They stepped into a taxi, and the guy went, "Absolutely, Mr. Styles."
Yeah, like there's some weird fuckers there. I ain't gonna lie to you. I get tripped out every time I go.
You mentioned Leguizamo there, and he was last seen taking John's car for repair.
Yeah.
Hasn't shown up since. So
you know, I love John Leguizamo. I'm a huge, huge fan. And even though he's got smaller roles in one and two, his presence is a big world builder. Mm-hmm. I fucking love. I tried. Oh, so and good. I love Jimmy the Cop.
Yeah.
You know, for that, we've had them in both. And those characters were all in the first. Every one of them was in the first couple of drafts of the script. It's just you get to the point where, like, okay, now I've got a 130-page script. You know, they all felt like I had forced him in. Yeah. You just got to be honest with yourself and do it. Plus, you know, Common had a knife in his heart at the end of the last one. It was hard
It's hard to get come back from that.
Especially when it picks up straight away, you know. Yeah. It's tough.
And, you know, I think in the universe that we're trying to create, you will see all three of them again.
Fantastic. Chad, we got to let you go. I mean, sure. I could talk to you all day about Chechep and Yaya and that amazing fight. That's
fucking
Jesus.
Huge fans. And when Keanu found out we get him, you never saw a bigger smile, and you never saw a bigger worry. Because they are fast as fuck, and they're fantastic. Yeah. And we're all about the same age, which is good. but they were, when they said yes, and we got Yaya and Chechep to fly out to New York, Yaya had never been in America, let alone New York.
Wow.
So just to see that reaction. And then you combine that with the opening scene with Boban in the beginning. So you have an 8-foot tall guy and then 2 5-feet tall guys.
Yeah.
And to combine Penchak Silat the way they do it with, you know, jiu-jitsu and the Jiu-Jitsu Canadas, it was just one of the funnest ways to choreograph I've ever done with, because they are masters.
Yeah.
And they are fun, and they are the nice, literally none of the dialogue scene you saw with them was in the script at all. Every time they'd switch it on during the rehearsals and you think they're the most badass guys ever. And then we'd yell, cut, okay, listen. And they'd start smiling, laughing, help Keanu up and go, oh, Mr. Reeves, are you okay? They were the most in awe of Keanu, as much as Keanu was in awe of them. And it was like the second day of shooting The Glass House, and they were kept doing the same thing. And Keanu's like, we got to put that in the movie. Like, I just have him help me up, and then we'll start. And we
it's amazing.
And we went, okay, pause, everybody go to lunch early. And me and Keanu sat there, and we just wrote 2 more scenes for him. We're like, well, they're going to help you up. Then you're going to get up and go, no, I don't want any help. And then that's actually Keanu falling down in that shot, too. He actually, the real guy just fell back down because he's fucking knackered. And they actually help him up, and then Chep's like, all right, I'm not going to fucking help you then. And then they started talking. Then when they go through the glass, they're like, okay. And Keanu's like, well, I want to show him respect. I want to kill these guys. I love you. All right. So Sanama, you know. And that all came about just because how fucking cool Chep and Yeon are.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Very cool.
Sorry, I go off on a tangent.
No, it's fine.
It's worth talking about because they were the funnest guys. Yeah. Them and Mark Dacascos, funnest guys to work with.
I was on set the day that you were on that glass house scene, and they were there to prep for the next day.
Yeah.
But it was just even just seeing them on set, I was getting quite excited about what was in store.
Fun, right?
It was that was really, really cool. Yeah, watching Keanu actually slam into glass stuff was fun. Don't break your leading man, Chad. Honestly.
Everybody jokes with me like, well, you were just stunk. Like, yeah, it's payback, man. Well, but it's not. He's just like, he never wants you to hold back on the choreography because of a limitation in him. Like, if you saw the ice bath he goes into every night, it's literally they have this little kitty tub that you inflate.
Yeah.
And it's got ice water pumped through it, and he'll sit in it for an hour every night just to get up the next day. So he's quite tough.
Well, you know, there's a line in the movie that sums it up. Art is pain.
I'm probably Nietzsche's biggest fan. I believe it. The purpose of life is art, and life is pain. All right, sorry, art is pain, life is suffering.
There we go. Fantastic.
But thank you, boys.
Chad Stahelski, pleasure, man. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, so that was Chad Stahelski. One of our Fit Directors, Helen, no?
Yes, absolutely. A perennial entry on the Fit Directors list that will never, ever be written, apparently. Ever. Ever.
I mean, it sounds like a book, don't you think?
Like that would be an amazing book.
Like someone asked me recently, someone said to me, "Do you, you know, where's your book?
Where's your novel?
Where's your book?" Novel is one thing.
No, okay, non-fiction bestseller, Chris.
But where's your, like, you know, you've written some books. Yeah. Nick Desemlian has a book coming out.
Fantastic book,
Wild
yeah.
and Crazy Guys. Where's my book?
Yeah.
I don't really have a book.
And maybe your book is?
Fit Directors. But it has to be written with you because, obviously. You know, that'll head off several oppositions at the pass.
Brilliant. Let's
there
do
we go.
It. Okay.
Okay. Welcome to the John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum Spoiler Special. We don't have a lot of time to really dig deep into this film, but what do we make of it? I guess it's essentially just a long chat, you and I, about this film and whether we liked it and where it stands up next to the previous two films.
I mean, I like it a lot. I'll be honest, I know there's been a lot of talk with talk about this in the office. I feel like I think the first is still my favorite, not in terms of the action being the best in the first, because I do think they've successfully raised the action stakes each time. Mm-hmm. But I feel like just the elegance of the first one hasn't been surpassed yet. And while I enjoy them kind of widening the mythology and making it more and more complicated each time and making this kind of the world building that they do with this insane and frankly economically unfeasible world of assassins, I enjoy it a lot. But it you know, the more you look into it, the less it makes sense.
Unless, of course, you look at it under it takes place under the veil of a dream world,
under
right? Under the high table, you know, this whole descent into hell thread that is running through the movies. You know, Chad Stahelski mentioned Dante's Inferno is an inspiration for him. The idea that John Wick is digging ever deeper and going through, you know, ever decreasing circles of hell as he tries to get out of this world. Certainly, it means that there seems like a supernatural bent to some of the things that are beginning to happen in this world now. The Syed Tagmoui character, for example, who just appears out of nowhere when John Wick goes into the desert and he's tempting John Wick. And there's, you know, is he the devil? Is there something in that as well? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So maybe they don't need to apply plot logic to this movie.
But then you've
on
got the devil excommunicating people. That's weird.
Well, the devil has rules as well, right?
I mean, classically, not really.
he's like a dog chasing cars.
Well, I mean, the Church of Satan, for example, is very much anti-rules. You know, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
But then they also sued that.
That's true, they do. Well, they'll use our laws.
Someone had a statue recently. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so they're
use
bound
our
by
laws.
Certain laws. Yeah.
No,
okay.
No, but that's not them like buying into those laws. That's them using and abusing those laws. But,
okay.
So I don't know. I feel like that maybe complicates the mythology even further. Oh, so complicated. But having said that, I do enjoy that, and I do the sort of enjoy the kind of quasi-religious trappings of this world that he's in, and you know, the crucifix and the branding and the excommunication.
But as I pointed out to Chad Stahelski, whenever John Wick gets the tattoo, when he gets the branding, his ticket to get into to get out of America, and to go to Casablanca, it's an upside down crucifix.
It is, yeah.
So I think he is playing on some level with notions of heaven and hell and good and evil here, and what John Wick's role within that is. But it's interesting, I don't think you've heard the interview yet, but it's interesting that he talked about how he wanted to kill John Wick in this movie initially. That's how the movie was going to end, with him dying.
Uh-huh.
Didn't ask how exactly. I didn't really think it was relevant, but now I think back, I probably should have asked. But you know, hey-ho, you prioritize within the room, right?
Sure.
But he also said that the ultimate idea of this franchise is that John, there's no escape. There's no escape from this, that John is essentially doomed, whether that's doomed to death or just doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. But it makes me wonder, like, where can they go? So if, for example, we're going into John Wick Chapter 4, which has already been announced, it's got a 2021 release date, and you'd imagine Stahelski will come back for that. Certainly Keanu Reeves will. Where can they go? If there's no escape for John Wick, what's our investment in it?
So my expectation for this film, I probably coloured my first viewing, because I thought this was maybe it. I thought this was maybe an ending.
I thought it was.
And I was surprised that he didn't take down the entire high table or something of that sort, or certainly confront them as a group at some point. That was kind of what I was expecting. And now I feel like we're looking at 4 or 5 films, because I don't think we're close enough to the end for that yet. I don't know if that sort of nihilism will survive 2 more films. I can see him dying, but maybe not dying in vain.
He's got to die in service of a cause, right?
In service of the table.
No,
ideally,
he's got, for me, if this does end with John Wick dying, and I kind of hope it doesn't in a way, because I grow more attached to him the less he says. But I do.
And the more time he spends with his dog.
There's something poetic about him dying at the end of being reunited with Helen.
With Helen. Made for each other.
But at the same time, I would like him to survive and to show that there is light in the darkness here and to show that he has something to live for. And besides, who's going to look after his dog?
I know. Think of the dog, people. Come on. I guess I'm okay with a glorious end if I have to be, because I think this is a clearly rotten system and somebody should probably take it down. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to have, even if you're going to have a world full of assassins, you've got to be able to give up assassining at some point if you want to. and the high table, that, like, clearly this whole, you know, I have served, I will be of service. Mm. There are really nasty kind of connotations there of you're locked in for life to kind of, you're honor bound to these organizations. Mm-hmm. It's whether you want to sort of refer to the mafia omerta, or you want to refer to kind of even nastier things, maybe not quite slavery, but certainly indentured servitude and that kind of thing. There are some really nasty precedents for that kind of behavior, and that is not good. I am going to go out on a limb and say it's not good.
That
our hero should take that system down.
He should take it down. But again, Stahelski would seem to suggest that he won't be able to take it down, that the high table is too big, it's too powerful. Yeah. And maybe there's a reference there to our current political situation where you have, for example, you have in America, you know, we're recording this just after Robert Mueller has essentially come out at a press conference and gone, we didn't have any confidence that the president hadn't committed a crime. Let's put it that way. But we can't indict a sitting president. The system is so fucked. We can't do that. And maybe the high table, it has its feet under the high table of power so much now that it can't be taken down, no matter how talented John Wick is, no matter how powerful the Bowery King is, because clearly those two guys are going to team up in the next one.
Excited about that.
Which I'm, very, very cool, because I thought they'd killed him. I thought they'd killed the Bowery King with that seven cuts business with Zero.
Yeah, I was hoping not. So yeah. I was pleased that he hadn't. But they have clearly damaged his power base and you know, killed a lot of his lieutenants. So
TikTok man seems to be still around.
TikTok man's fine. That's an important one. I hope Carrie Ann Moss turns up at some point soon. I do think they're going to team up, but I think they have to. I think they have to be able to make a dent in the system. I think otherwise, again, like I say, I'm just not here for nihilism these days in cinema, and I don't want that. So, you know, Chad, if you're listening, please, please don't make everything be in vain.
If you're still listening after the Fit Director business.
Maybe that's what made him tune in, you know? I don't know.
Chad, there's this podcast you should listen to. They talk about how fit you are. What is that? Is that a British term?
Hot directors. Yeah. But I'm very much enjoying the ride, and I'm very much enjoying some of the new characters here, you know, Angelica Houston, obviously, you know.
Yeah,
free
she's
pass
great.
For life. I mean, she's Morticia Adams, so that's all I need to know.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's very good. Halle Berry was interesting. I really liked her. I thought that sort of first-person shooter sequence was really effective.
Yes.
My only thing there is I don't understand where she's going at the end of that scene. I don't know what situation she's meant to be in.
Her motivation seems to shift from scene to scene. That's one thing. I do wonder, because there's four credited writers in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Derek Kolstad, who wrote the first two movies, pretty much, I think he was credited on his own, is credited here, but he's not the sole writer. And I wonder if maybe his influence is waning. Maybe he's focused on other projects. I know he's overseeing the Continental TV show, for example. So maybe there is some dilution of intent. Or maybe just as things naturally move along, Stahelski and Reeves are becoming the keepers of the flame of this franchise. But certainly I think that Sophia went from, you know, wanting to help John to not wanting to help John, to then not wanting to burn everything down, but then she does burn everything down. She knows she doesn't have to do that, because A, her dog hasn't been shot dead. She's been shot. You could maybe let that go. Maybe she's just appalled by Jerome Flynn's accent. She doesn't know what it is, where it's from.
No,
so she has to unleash fire.
I think it's very much in line with this series that she would shoot someone for shooting her dog. That absolutely makes sense.
The code of conduct.
Yeah, absolutely.
The rules.
I mean, this is clearly a film made for dog people and not cat people. Witness the one person who says he's a cat person later in the movie. I'm totally up on board with that. But I'm not sure, given how concerned she seems to be at the beginning of her scenes about not messing up her position at the Continental, she loses that pretty quickly. And also, frankly, at that point, she has already screwed up, because she has walked John Wick through the crowded lobby of the Casablanca Continental to her quarters. You're telling me she doesn't have a private room door? Come on, people. so I feel like that was a strategic error on the part of her lieutenant. That seemed like a bad idea.
But it does lead to that great action sequence, which is fantastic. And it's also the first time, I think, in this entire franchise where we've seen the action focus on someone other than John Wick.
Yeah, very much so.
Like, she takes over for like 2 or 3 minutes with her incredible dogs.
Yeah.
And it's basically, I love the bit where she turns the camera and goes, can I have a spin-off, please? Please, can I have a spin-off?
No, but I think we'll see her maybe in a bigger role next time.
You think? Because I'm thinking spin-off. I think they're world-building here. And, you know, she was... We were promised a Jinx spin-off from Die Another Day.
Yeah.
And that never happened. We were promised a Storm spin-off from X-Men.
That never
happened.
Third time lucky.
Third time lucky. Go for it, Hallie. Yeah, very, very good indeed. We have been sent some questions.
Oh,
if you heard typing at the beginning of the podcast as Helen was talking, I was basically going, hey, do you want to send in some questions for us? And we've got some questions. And I haven't read these, so I'm just going to... click on this.
Okay.
Dean at Dean BMMV asks, do you think Winston has just been playing John throughout as a pawn against a high table, or was he genuinely, regardless of brutal falls, on Wick's side? Also, what was with Bronn's accent?
Yeah. Well, I can't answer the second question for a start.
Nobody knows.
I think he was a bit of both. I think he's an opportunist as well as a planner. I think he used John Wick exactly as he needed to put himself in the best position possible.
Yes. Did that surprise you? It surprised me, I'll be honest. I thought I did expect the way the movie was going. I was expecting Charon, Winston and John Wick to go against a high table, because that's what they've been doing. They've been setting their stall out. I didn't expect it to end the way it did.
No, I didn't. It caught me by surprise as well. Maybe it shouldn't have done. He has been a guy who obviously had respect for the laws, or we wouldn't have excommunicated him last time. He's also a guy who plays both sides and obviously has some affection for John Wick. Otherwise, he wouldn't have given him the hour that he did. You know,
unless the hour was a political move.
Unless he was trying to provoke the high table against him. But what's the benefit to him in doing that?
I think he's really playing the long game. I mean, it's one of those bullshit movie plots, isn't it? It's like the Joker in The Dark Knight or Silva in Skyfall, where their plan is so intricate that it requires even Simo in Civil War, right? Their plan requires so many moving parts to fall into place at exactly the right place at exactly the right time, and then at the end they're all going, hey, look at this. Look at what a genius I am. But if anything goes wrong along the way. So by giving John the extra hour and then whipping the high table up and being an absolute prick to the adjudicator, that perhaps he's positioning John in the perfect place so John will go to the elder and then come back and then he has John to use as a weapon against the high table, then maneuvering himself into a position where the adjudicator goes, all right, so kill John Wick and everything is forgiven and you get your hotel back.
No, I think he gave John Wick an hour out of friendship. I do.
Okay.
And then I think he played the resulting...
paternal feelings,
maybe,
perhaps?
Maybe, paternal-ish, paternal-esque feelings. And then he played the resulting mess, which I don't think he expected. I think that's genuine surprise on his face when the adjudicator tells him he's in trouble. He then played it as best he could to get out of it. But he still kind of hedged his bets at the end by shooting John in the coat, which we know
is
tactical.
Yeah. Big fall.
I mean, sure. Yeah.
big fall of the...
There's no way that John Wick is dying in a fall. Come on.
Yeah. But at the end when he says Baba Yaga, I think there's a genuine, oh shit, what have I done kind of... I think he expected John to die in that fall. I think at the end he's like, oh fuck, I've just pissed off John Wick.
I don't get that from that at all. There was a little smile there at the end. I think he's all right.
You think?
Yeah.
I don't think Winston's going to maneuver out of this one.
I would never bet against him maneuvering. I feel like he's a good maneuverer. And he has Charon on his side. And Charon is a powerful ally, I feel like. Although he does sacrifice his footmen like nothing. Like nobody's business.
Yeah,
I mean, all those per bus boys just gone.
But there's plenty more where that came from.
Apparently, who is signing up for those jobs, though? You know,
we're at least like
wanted bellboy must have martial arts and arms training. Like,
it's difficult to staff up the Continental. It must be.
I would have thought,
because you can't. You know, it must be too hard to book. Like, here's my thinking. Like, can you book as a normal person? If you're like in New York and you're tired and you get off your flight and you don't have a hotel booked, or it's fallen through at the last minute and you walk in the streets and you got your bag, and you see, oh, there's a hotel across the street, the Continental. I'll walk in there. Can you go there as a punter?
So I think you can. And I think that you wouldn't even know anything was happening because of all the rules.
Because there's no gunfire usually in a Continental. Yeah. What if you saw all these people exchanging these weird coin things? You're like, what the hell's going on there? I'd like to be a part
You'd
of it.
You'd be like, oh, it's a gift card Members scheme we have.
Yeah. Okay. Like Sparks points for M&S.
Yeah, or like when you go to Liberty and their gift vouchers are coins.
Hang on.
That's a relatable and fancy.
Are you saying Liberty's part of the Continental chain of hotels?
Do you know what? It would totally be. It 100% would be because it's fancy and it's a bit weird. Mm-hmm. It definitely would be. Yes, that is now in my head canon.
Two more things before we get into some more really quick fire questions. We're recording this a couple of weeks after I've seen the film, and usually I like to see a film more than once before we do a spoiler special, but I was unable to. So my memory's hazy on certain aspects of the movie, then please forgive me. And Helen, you've seen it twice, but again, there's been a couple of weeks, I think, since your second
viewing. And the second time I saw it was straight after a marathon, so it was kind of interactive because everything hurt, much like John Wick. I may have been less than on full form.
Next thing is a question from @ChrisHewitt, who asks, which is your favourite Continental? Casablanca, Rome, or New York?
Ooh. I mean, I'd very happily stay in any of them, to be honest, because I'd know I wasn't going to get assassinated there, which would be a bonus. Obviously, I usually lose sleep about that.
All the time.
Rome was a little Baroque, and I prefer Gothic traditionally. I like the sort of neoclassical thing that the New York has going on, but I've never been to Casablanca, and it's kind of been on my list for a little while, so I'm going to go with that one.
Casablanca. I like the clean lines of New York.
I mean, it's very attractive, don't get me wrong. I think they've had a decorator in since we saw it last. I like the stained glass windows a lot. And also the rooftop fireplace. I'm not sure it's terribly practical, but it's very stylish.
David Mackin asks, on a scale of 1 to pencil, how bad an idea was it for the elder to take John's wedding ring? Surely we will see a beautifully fine-lit retrieval of said ring in one of the many, many Wick sequels. And in fact, James and Chaz Stahelski had a really interesting discussion about that, because James is someone who was like, well, I would never give up my wedding ring. I've had to take mine off because it hurts my finger. But otherwise, I wouldn't give it up.
Obviously.
Either. But where do you stand on that?
I think we're definitely going to see him get it back. I don't think there's any scenario where he leaves that.
What do you think about the gesture of him even giving it up? This is a man for whom his marriage meant everything, means everything.
Yeah, I think that is a signal to us as viewers that this isn't over, that this is not him, you know, acquiescing entirely to the high table again. I actually took a weird sort of comfort from that scene, because it meant that, okay, it's now not a case where the world is out to get him and everyone's trying to kill him. It's now a case where he has some maneuverability, some wiggle room, I think. I got that was a loss, and I got that was a huge sacrifice on his part, and I got that was a move of desperation. But at the same time, it felt, in storytelling terms, immediately like a ray of light.
It was interesting because he gives his wedding ring up, agrees to go and kill Winston. And then we actually had a slight disagreement here. I think he immediately just decides not to kill Winston and goes against what he's agreed to do for the elder. Stahelski doesn't think that's the case. But obviously he then aligns himself with Winston against the elder and therefore the high table.
Yeah.
And I wonder why he does that, really.
Well, I just think it's a move of desperation, certainly. But I think it is also kind of in line with this kind of organization. Okay, let's get historical for a second. So excommunication obviously has been used by, you know, well, mostly the Catholic Church. That's the most famous form of it. It's used by a lot of Protestant sects as well.
And what are you talking about?
But it is, you know, it's the shunning and that kind of thing that you get in some smaller religions. But in the Catholic Church, it used to have, like, just mind-blowing consequences. So I think it was King John of England was excommunicated at one point. And that meant, like, nobody in England could be baptized or have last rites or get married under the church. Like, it was massive. And you did have to make some kind of obeisance to get back into the church's good book. So, like, when William the Conqueror was excommunicated for marrying his cousin without permission, because it was totally fine to marry your cousin, but you had to get it signed off first, they both had to build a new abbey in their hometown of Caen, and that those still stand today. Same with Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain, a couple of abbeys, all's forgiven, all's well. So I feel like this, him giving up the ring, is him building an abbey. Essentially moving himself back into the good books.
Masterfully done. A little bit of a history lesson there from Helen O'Hara. At Gilo809, Julio Balbuena on Twitter asks, which other objects do you think are going to be lethal in Wick's hands? We've seen a book, we've seen a pencil, we've seen a belt so far. What do we think in 4 and 5 and 6 and 7?
A cuddly toy? I mean, what is the most innocent?
Kildebear.
Killed a bear, very good.
That's what we need.
Something innocent and apparently non-lethal. I'm just looking around the room. I'm seeing a backpack, a water bottle, a phone.
This is like the worst episode of the Generation Game ever.
Sunglasses. He hasn't killed anyone with a pair of glasses yet.
Hasn't killed anyone with sunglasses. If you're in a hotel room, like a bottle opener. I've never seen anyone killed with a bottle opener.
No.
Like maybe, you know, not the stabby part, yes, but the actual bit that you use to prise open the lid of a, the, you know.
Yeah,
the,
yeah, like a beer bottle opener.
Yeah.
Interesting.
One of those. Why not?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Can I just say how much I adored the fact that he goes into this antique store and it turns out that upstairs is a floor full of weapons. It seems like maybe he went for that floor, so maybe he knew it was there, but he goes to the floor.
Yes, what a stroke of luck.
Full of cases of weaponry. First of all, cleans and puts back together and makes work a gun.
Yeah.
Just to slow everybody down for a second with a few shots. I presume those are parabellum rounds, I assume. I don't know for sure. I don't know enough about guns. But then you have that wonderful fight in what I like to call Chekhov's corridor, where they suddenly realize they're fighting in a little row lined with cabinets full of machetes and hatchets, yeah, knives of all sorts. And they just start throwing each other into the cabinets to break the glass, mm-hmm, and then throwing the contents of the cabinets at one another. It's glorious.
It's an incredible scene. And we should talk about the action in this movie, and we should talk about the violence in this movie, because it took me by surprise, some of the violence. I mean, that knife in the eye, wowzers. Don't try this at home, folks. John Wick is a professional. I have to say, the first 20 minutes of this movie I thought was fantastic. And this was the movie I thought the entire movie was going to be, which I thought it was going to be John Wick on the run, just fighting off a relentless wave of assassins.
I feel like that might have been too much. I was getting to the point where it was too much after those 20 minutes.
But Stahelski has talked, and not just to us, but he's talked about how he wants to induce action fatigue in people. He wants you to feel a slog, because I guess that mirrors what John Wick is going through. But I think you're absolutely right. From a dramatic point of view, had that been the case, it might have got a little bit dull. Even the raid, which is, you know, for my money, this is as close in intensity and execution of the stunts and the action to the raid and raid 2
and personnel,
the night comes for us and indeed, and the villainess, you know, so, you know, Gareth Evans movies and, you know, the action movies from Indonesia and South Korea over the last few years is as close as any American movie has come to nailing that level of intensity, which is incredible. The knife fight, the horse foo, the motorcycle chase, you know, just, it's so exhilarating, that stuff.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
The horse thing was just magic. He's just kicking people in the head via a horse. He's magic.
I think it does take a little breather, and then it ratchets us back up again for that incredible fight with Chechep and Yayan from The Raid 2. And
it's almost, it is almost boss levels.
It's
working your way up again through a tower. Even though actually he fights them on the same level that he then fights
Zero,
and then has to go back up when they crash down through the floor.
Yeah.
So, which is interesting, just from a sort of, you know.
Yeah.
Metaphorical point of view, they're on the same level as him, even though they're kind of presented in the film as his students or apprentices.
And of course, they beat him. There's a moment where they can kill him. Yeah. They have him at their mercy, but they've been told not to by Ciro. But for them also, it's about the honor of fighting with John Wick, which I think is one of the reasons why he leaves them alive as well. He maybe sees that there's honor and nobility and intent there. And I hope we do get to see those guys again.
I feel like we will.
I hope we get to see Ico from the Raid movies as well, because that guy can kick ass. Something rotten. That'd be really, really cool. There are people to come back for 4 and 5 and 6 and 7. And I don't think Keanu Reeves is going to give up on this character anytime soon. He loves playing this character.
He adores it, yeah.
And, you know, where is John Leguizamo? He took he took John's car for repair in Chapter 2.
Good point.
I thought by now he would have had repaired and it would have roared into action in the last act of this movie. But clearly not. They're keeping him on the board. There's Common, last seen with a knife in his heart.
That's true.
But still alive.
Still alive.
You know,
could theoretically live if he doesn't move.
Yeah.
Gets to help soon enough.
Good surgeon.
Yeah. Very, 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 I mean, really
very good surgeon.
Halle Berry's obviously still on the board. Sophia.
Yeah. absolutely. And the Bowery King, and maybe we could see Jason Mantzoukas do something more than just say, TikTok, Mr. Wick, you know.
I mean, he said it very well, but yes. I'm interested to see if we see Charon step away a little bit from Winston, or if that remains solid, or if he becomes a sort of conduit between
interesting.
Them.
Interesting, interesting.
Because I do think that Winston made peace with the High Table because he saw it as a, you know, the safest option, but I don't think he's loyal in any meaningful sense. So we might see some more kind of Wick connections there that are not entirely violent and deadly. And I'm excited to see who they bring into this as well. I mean, what amazing action stars have we not seen that he could tangle with? And don't say like Chuck Norris. It needs to be people who are still able to kick ass.
Scott Adkins.
Yeah, okay.
Scott Adkins of the Empire podcast. Because then I think we would be fighting vicariously through him. By him being in the movie, the Empire podcast would therefore essentially be fighting John Wick.
Okay.
For me, they have to go for Carrie-Anne Moss, don't they?
Yes, they do. They really do.
And Sandra Bullock.
Amazing. 10 stars. Sign me up. Right now. Amazing. I want it. I need it. It must happen.
It has to be people from Keanu Reeves' past. It has to be.
That would be, I can't even bear how good that is. Wow.
On a bus.
Wow.
John Wick on a bus.
Also William Sadler.
William Sadler.
Yep.
Fighting in the nude with using the remote control.
I wasn't even thinking about that. I was thinking about death, man. He is death.
Oh my God.
In Bill and Ted.
We've got so many questions. It's going to work. We've got so many questions. Very, very quickly, because most of them are along the lines of, what do we want to see next? How many chapters do we think it's going to run to? You've said 5. That sounds right to me.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm sure it could rumble on for a few more yet. And who we'd like to see, we've answered that already.
Oh, Hugo Weaving too.
Hugo Weaving. Someone did say Hugo Weaving. Can he be the bad guy in the next one? Fastest duck in the city, Dr. Horrible. Dr. Horrible on Twitter asks, do you think John putting the book back on the shelf in the library was good or bad book etiquette?
Very good book etiquette. He replaced it in the right place, and also it was his little secret stash that still has his wife's photo in it, if I remember correctly.
I think
correctly.
That's going to be important.
I wonder.
Going down the line. Mm. I've got a sneaking suspicion about that. But his membership may have been revoked. You never know. It was great seeing that.
Such a good scene. Really, really good fight scene.
Love and the it. First time when he actually kills the guy, and that's a basketball star in real life, I think, when he actually kills the guy, that's the first time I went, oh fuck, it's going there.
Yeah. It really is.
It really is going there. What animal weaponry would you like to see in John Wick 4? Team up with Squirrel Girl, perhaps? Or
yes.
some chipmunks? Do you think there were a few too many scenes of the sexy tattooed telephone operators sending messages over old-looking computer systems? It seemed like we were laying it on a bit thick and padding for time. Padding for time. I love that idea. Oh, guys, this film's only running at 1 hour, 10 minutes. We need 20 minutes of people answering the phone. Quickly!
Yeah, it did get a little wearing in that first few minutes, but, you know, they calmed it down after that. They were just trying to get the countdown feeling in there. I loved the Chinese doctor scene. I thought that was great.
Carl Friedrich Frieden asks, was there anything in the movie that made you wince more than a toenail? The entire theatre had a sudden intake of breath during that one, but we were fine with the knife in the eye.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, I did it after a marathon, so I was very conscious of my toenails at the time, which have not fallen off. Hashtag blessed. But yeah, that was a really unpleasant scene. And I agree. I think it's the most body horror moment in the movie. And there are quite a lot of body horror moments.
Whisker Drum asks, what are your thoughts on Jason Mantzoukas getting his own poster?
I mean, well done him and his agent, I guess.
At Cantona's Ghost, could there be a spin-off where there's a specialist canine continental version of Hotel for Dogs?
No, but I would watch a short with the dog and Chiron?
That's
hanging out together. Yeah. I think they'd be delightful together. They seem to have a really strong relationship.
All right. Okay. So overall, then, Helen, where do you stand in this movie in relation to the previous two? Is it the best, second best, or third best of the franchise?
I would put them all very much on a level. I do think the first is still my favourite just for its elegance and its surprise factor.
Because of the way it's so focused.
Yeah, exactly. And I enjoy the widening of the mythology in the world, and I take pleasure from that as well, but it's not as pure as that first one.
Is there an argument that as they're expanding it, and as they're frankly they're making this shit up as they go,
sure,
that they are weakening in some ways the through line of John Wick, which was a man grieving over his wife, has a dog, gets emotionally attached to the dog real quick, and you would because it was so cute. Oh. So cute. Gets killed, goes out for revenge. Everyone shits himself because he's the best assassin in the business. And it's that simple.
Yeah. I mean, and he's essentially, in that first one, he's essentially taking out his grief on the world. He essentially can finally blame someone for taking his wife away from them, even though what they actually took was his dog. That emotionally makes a lot of sense. I think the second one maybe as a result struggled a little bit. It didn't have quite as an emotional clarity.
The motivation, they were struggling, I think, with the motivation.
Yeah, and I think this one he has desperation driving him. Rather than, but you don't have that clarity. So just in you're right. In that sense, I think the first one is the strongest. Obviously, in the action sense, I think the second and third have been better.
Yeah.
But I'm very happy to have all of them. I don't feel the need to pit them against each other. Actually,
I'm not sure I'd watch them as a triple bill. It might get a little bit bludgeoning.
I think that would be a bit much. Yeah, I think you need to space them out. But they are. I will rewatch this one just as I have rewatched the first and second multiple times.
I think the second is the best for me because it has a purity of concept as well, and I know the motivation. It's a little hinky in terms of, you know, getting John back onto the board after, because the first one is nicely self-contained and it wraps up his story fairly nicely.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't a John Wick 2, we'd be going, that's a really, you know, really good. But it's also, I think the first movie can be bracketed with the likes of Taken, you know, and the sort of the Jerry action movies where the slightly older leading man is kicking ass and taking names and he's out for revenge. And even though I think that by expanding the world building and by just, again, as I said, frankly, making this up as they go along, they're diluting some of the impact of John's central story. They're setting these movies apart from those other movies because they feel unlike anything else in American, in mainstream American action cinema right now, certainly for the last 20, 30 years. And they also look amazing.
They're gorgeous.
They look, these movies are shot incredibly well. Dan Laustsen, the cinematographer, take a bow, sir. Works a lot with Guillermo del Toro and shot The Shape of Water, and this movie is,
it's gorgeous,
phenomenal.
And I love that we've moved on from that sort of really murky blue, you know, tired action movie look to this kind of, you know, the outrageous styles of the different fights in this movie, that sort of neon, rainbow neon opening scenes. I just adore that. I love that we're kind of taking some risks and doing some crazy stuff now. And I mean, this is, I think I would say this is almost more in common with, you know, visually with like a Blade Runner than it does with Taken. You know, it's visually completely worlds apart from that.
Yeah, it's a future noir. It's absolutely that. It's absolutely beautiful. And, two last things I want to talk about real quick. We haven't talked about Mark Dacascos. I'm delighted to see Mark Dacascos kicking ass. He's in his 50s. He's really fun. Someone said that the character is a lovely take on toxic fanboy. You know, and that he's trying to destroy the thing he loves and he doesn't want anyone else to have it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go near after John Wick, I'm going to kill you too. All that sort of stuff. But he brought a real playfulness to it as well. He's still in the table, kind of, but I don't think we're going to see him again.
Yeah, I think he was dying there. I think that was pretty clear. I was also, I kind of felt like we almost missed a line from John, which is not surprising because he doesn't say a lot.
He really doesn't.
Where, you know, because Mark Dacascos tries to do the whole, we're alike, you and I. And John just goes, no, we're not. But there's no like explanation of, you know, you do this thing that I would never do, or you value this thing that I never would. It's just a denial, a straight denial. And I wondered if there was more to that or if there was more that we could have taken from that, which I was missing.
Maybe we'll have a full-on John Wick monologue in the next movie.
Oh,
a four-page, nails it. Yeah. Absolutely nails it.
To double tap in the head or not to double tap in the head? That is the question. Whether it is nobler
to always
in the mind.
Double tap in the head. That is his signature move. You hold down the L button and you double tap X a couple of times and that's John Wick's move.
That's it.
That's amazing. Pretty much it. But just it's interesting, you know, we're talking about whether this will culminate in John Wick dying. And John Wick's attitude towards his own death is fascinating as well, because this is a guy who I think is weirdly paradoxically ready to die, and yet he will do anything in his power to stop himself from dying.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah, I think he was ready to lie down and die at the beginning of the first film. Absolutely.
But also, when Santino, at the beginning of the second movie, when Santino gives him the marker, and John says no. Mm-hmm. John, there's a moment where John is almost, he looks at this picture of Helen and then Santino blows up his house. And I think John's expecting to die in that moment. Mm-hmm. So I think he's at peace with the idea of dying. And then he's also someone that, but once you actually do it, once you commit the physical act of trying to kill John Wick and it doesn't work,
yeah,
something on the lizard level in him lashes out, yeah, and he gets very, very angry very, very quickly, it's and woe betide you.
If you're going to come for me, you better not miss, kind of thing, isn't it?
Damn straight. Another thing we should talk about.
Yeah.
Oh my God, we will get out of here. This is going to be 20 minutes. The Adjudicator, played, of course, by Asia Kate Dillon, who is so brilliant on Billions.
Yeah. And I think they are really interesting in terms of being this incredibly controlled, reserved character, because what we saw of the High Table last time was Santino, who was like all over the place. Like he was incredibly passionate and incredibly unpredictable and incredibly dangerous. And the Adjudicator this time is much more withdrawn and reserved, much more of an apparatchik and a sort of functionary, but clearly has a lot of power at the same time. So just with that, you know, the gloves in the hand, no obvious weapon whatsoever, and everyone is terrified of them, which I think is beautiful, beautiful performance on Asia Kate Dillon's part, because I think that, you know, what an actor. I haven't seen a lot of Billions, but I read a bunch of reviews of their performance and it just sounds amazing.
Yeah, they're great. That's not trying to say a Billions spoiler special, but there's a sense that once their character Taylor comes into the show, that the show pivots in a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
And characters that were the forefront recede to the background as the creators, from my point of view, become less interested in him and become really interested in this character they created, Taylor, who's fascinating. Lots of stuff to dig into, lots of stuff to set up for the future as well, but we don't have a lot more time. In fact, we have no time. We have run out of time. TikTok, Helen O'Hara, TikTok. That is it for our John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum spoiler special. We hope you've enjoyed it. There will be more spoiler specials coming your way very, very soon. Our final part of the Avengers Endgame Jamboree with the directors Joe and Anthony Russo and the writers Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely will be up very, very soon. It may even be up by the time you listen to this.
Ooh.
Who knows? We will have a spoiler special for Rocket Man with the director Dexter Fletcher. That'll be coming your way very, very soon as well. And we'll also have a spoiler special for X-Men Dark Phoenix with that film's writer-director Simon Kinberg. And we need to record both of those, Helen, at some point next week.
Hey, we should do that, yeah.
We should do that. We should totally do that. And not leave it 2 or 3 weeks as we did with this one.
Definitely not.
Circumstances will not intervene this time.
No.
I'm pretty sure.
Probably.
All right, we shall see. The regular Empire podcast is available every Friday as well. And until we meet again, until at a auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to give the Continental Casablanca 4 stars on TripAdvisor.
Ooh, only 4.
Room service wasn't great.
Yeah.
They try and kill me with a bottle opener.
That's rude.
Weird. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.